You're listening to the only 24-hour libertarian news and talk station. Climb aboard the Liberty Express.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. United Nations envoy Lakhdar Brahimi has announced that Syria's opposition and government will meet in the same room on Saturday as part of the continuing peace talks in Switzerland. Mr. Brahimi appears to have averted the collapse of the negotiations after threats from Damascus to abandon the process. The two sides have been blaming each other for a lack of progress. Lorna Shadek reports.
Lakhdar Brahimi seemed confident that neither side will walk out of the talks in the coming days and predicted they'd continue for another week. He said all sides understood that the conference is trying to save Syria. Mr. Brahimi spent 3 days trying to get the parties to meet, an encounter that was scheduled to happen for the first time this Friday. But instead, Mr. Brahimi met government delegates in the morning and the opposition in the afternoon. After a day of frantic negotiations, the two sides did agree to talk in the same room on Saturday, though it's still not clear if they'll face each other in the meeting or sit separately, with Mr. Brahimi shuttling between them, what's known as proximity talks. Diplomats say that when the parties do get together, they're now aiming to work on small concessions, including local truces rather than one overarching peace agreement.
There's chaos in Cairo. At least 6 people have died, with 100 more injured after a series of bomb blasts outside police stations across the city. Security has been on high alert in anticipation of the 3rd anniversary of the Arab Spring Uprising, which is coming up on Saturday. Tension continues to grow between military coup-led government forces and Muslim Brotherhood supporters. In Ukraine, protesters erected more barricades overnight in the central streets of Kiev. The opposition leaders rejected the government's terms to end the standoff as crowds gathered on Independence Square voted to withdraw from talks. The negotiations to end the political crisis, however, are set to continue as the opposition demands the government step down over a canceled integration deal with the EU. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
New barricades appeared overnight on Kyiv's central streets, where rioters protect the tent city on the Maidan or Independence Square. The opposition leaders rejected the government's terms to clear the city streets in exchange for a ceasefire and a promise to free the arrested activists. The sides, however, agreed to extend the truce reached on Thursday to avoid violence. The Maidan Self-Defense Unit representatives claimed to have seized the building of the Agrarian Policy Ministry early on Friday morning to give people a warm shelter. The Ukrainian government called for an emergency session of the country's parliament, Verkhovna Rada, on Tuesday next week. Prime Minister Mykola Azarov said his government will be ready to step down if the parliament decides so. The opposition demands the cabinet and the president to quit over an unpopular decision to withdraw from an association deal with the European Union.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. has warned against doing business with Iran in an apparent bid to dispel impressions the 6-month nuclear deal with the isolated nation means business as usual. Administration officials have stepped up calls on U.S. companies not to sign any contracts with Iran until after the 6-month nuclear agreement expires in July. Nina Maria Potts reports.
The U.S. says all sanctions against Iran remain in place, warning companies to hold off doing business with Iran until the 6-month nuclear agreement is up. The U.S. Treasury Department, meanwhile, has announced a $152 million settlement with a Luxembourg-based banking subsidiary of Germany's Deutsche Börse Securities Exchange for allowing Iran to bypass sanctions by using the subsidiary's access to U.S. banking systems. The Treasury said the move should serve as a reminder to companies not to do business with sanctioned parties. The administration has come under mounting criticism from U.S. lawmakers opposed to the 6-month nuclear deal. It was meant to give Iran a window of time to negotiate a more permanent deal. Critics say the agreement, which came into force on Monday, gives away far too much to the Iranians. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
And parts of Britain flooded in last month's storms and tidal surge might have to be abandoned to the sea forever, according to officials. The UK's Environment Agency is now in talks with nature bodies about which areas might be left to wildlife. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Parts of East Anglia might not be reclaimed from the sea, according to Paul Leinster, chief executive of the Environment Agency, the man in charge of protecting the UK's coastline. Around 373 acres of land are still underwater towards England's east coast. The Environment Agency says it now has to decide whether to reinstate some flood defences or allow fresh wildlife habitats to establish themselves. It's now in talks with conservation organisations about which areas should be left for wildlife.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
This is Liberty Express, your home for economics from a free market perspective.
You're listening to Liberty Express Radio. If you want to know more about any of the shows that broadcast on our network, simply click on the picture of the show's host and you'll be directed to their homepage. This will give you immediate access to all the resources available for that show. Thank you for listening.
I gotta turn them way up, and then, well, the music's turned up where it's supposed to be, and so I really would feel bad if I blew y'all speakers out or your eardrums. Hopefully your speakers will blow before your eardrums. Anyway, someone else is liable, not me. I don't know who, but not me. Beastie Boys, they got money. Sue them for your blown speakers and eardrums. Alright. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show today, topics and guests. That's right. Unlike all other radio shows, my show includes topics and guests. Makes it unique. Not so much. Anyway, I'm going to complain and point out important news stories I thought were important and what I thought was important about them. And then I'm also going to interview expert guests who know things about stuff a lot. Like Steven Zunis. He's going to be here to talk about Iraq. Now, I know that everybody wants to pretend that Iraq War II never happened. Well, that's why I want to talk about as much as I possibly can. Because I don't think that's fair. Destroy an entire society, you should at least have to be mildly aware of how destroyed it is because of the invasion that you did. I mean, assuming that you were a supporter, which you may not have been, but for those who helped cheerlead their state to war in Iraq, I think you kind of at least owe it to the people of Iraq and people who went and fought in that war. You owe it to them to at least, you know, be mildly aware of their current circumstances that you put them in. Pretty bad circumstances. And Eric Margolyes is going to be here too. He's going to be talking about the Ukraine. Now, why is it the Ukraine instead of just Ukraine? You know, I asked my father-in-law that and he doesn't know either. He's from there. I mean, the wife, she's from there, but she was a little girl. But the father-in-law, you would think that he would be able to tell me why anybody ever called it the Ukraine instead of Ukraine. He didn't know. He said something funny probably, but he didn't say an answer to the question. Maybe that's because people considered it for so long to simply be a region under the control of an imperial power, a Russian one. So it was the Ukraine. You know, like the Midwest, instead of Midwest, the state, or whatever, you know what I mean? There you go. Anyway, the Ukraine, I don't know, Ukraine. Well, so they got some things going on, and you can bet the CIA are up to their eyeballs and a thing going on somewhere, especially if it's going on in Ukraine. Am I right? The Ukraine? Anyway. So, we're going to hear from Eric Margulies about who's zooming who over there in Eastern Europe these days. And then also complaints of mine. For example, here it goes. I don't think it was very nice for a bunch of government employees to tell BuzzFeed that how badly they would like to murder Edward Snowden. Hey, what's the matter with you guys? You know, he was born with a natural, unalienable right to his own life. I can't prove it, but it's self-evident to me, so I don't have to. It's just true, because I said so. And so the deal is that you can't kill him. And the rules are, especially if you work for the federal government, well, the rules are if you're subject to America's government's jurisdiction, they'll prosecute you for murdering somebody because you don't have the right to murder people, only they do. And if you're a government employee, you don't get to murder somebody until after they've been indicted and then convicted and had all their appeals exhausted and then sentence carried out. And then you don't get to murder them. Some prison guard in a lab coat or some crap like that gets to pull the switch. Or they probably have a machine do it so it's nobody's fault, right? Like the firing squad shooting 10 blanks, but one real bullet. Anyway, it says in Amendment 5 of the U.S. Constitution, it says, if we're going to allow you pigs to be the pigs at all, one of our rules is you can't take our stuff away, you can't lock us in cages, and you can't have us killed until after a jury says it's okay. And after all of our appeals have been exhausted. Only then can you kill us. And so then the government said, okay, we'll abide by those rules. And so the Constitution was amended, and so those are the rules. You can't kill Ed Snowden unless you convict him of a capital offense. Otherwise, murder's murder, and then you go to jail, right? Or does anybody believe that, or what? Where are we in 2014? And how badly are these guys racing to prove Edward Snowden's point that they are a national security state, our supposed security force protectors up there in the national government, that they are lawless, that they are out of control, that they would violate your rights as well as his if they felt like it. And BuzzFeed ran this piece last week, and there are, you know, quite a few quotes in there of these guys talking about their fantasies of poisoning Ed Snowden to death or shooting him in the head or this, that, and the other thing. And then David Sirota has a piece out, which I hope will be running on antiwar.com tomorrow. I think so. It's at pandodaily.com. After BuzzFeed's killing Snowden story, three unanswered questions. And the first one, I might settle for the first one because the clock's ticking on this segment. I don't know. I might try to see if I can get through the others too. But man, the first one to me anyway, I think it's the first on his list. Yeah. Is silence or inaction a tacit endorsement of death threats? In other words, the U.S. government, Obama's government, will go to the ends of the earth. They'll even threaten to murder somebody. For leaking classified information. For saying something they're not authorized to say. Well, here you have anonymous government officials talking about how much they would like to murder Edward Snowden, and are they in trouble for that? Is Obama's government cracking down on the government employees who were running off at their mouth like this to BuzzFeed? Or do they not care? Is the Justice Department completely and totally uninterested in who might have been talking with them? As Sirota puts it, yeah, what about this insider threat program we read all about in McClatchy newspapers? Is it swinging into action now to identify these anonymous officials? And then, so if not, does that mean that Barack Obama thinks it's perfectly okay for officials in his government to anonymously threaten to murder Edward Snowden? It would seem like it to me, but you know. Who am I? Now, David Sirota, he says, I'm just asking. What do you think? So I'm just answering. I think it's correct. It is, in fact, a tacit endorsement of death threats if the Department of Justice does not go after these people who said this. And then he asks, well, when is it responsible to grant anonymity? It should be in journalism that underdogs get anonymity to take on power if they need it. A source who remains anonymous told us on condition of anonymity that they were witness to this congressman collecting that bribe from that businessman or whatever, right? You don't give anonymity to you do. Mass media does. They're not supposed to give anonymity to government officials to threaten to murder private citizens, no matter for what. And, of course, you know, American major media, they're legendary for giving government anonymity to smear whoever they feel like, especially leaders of foreign countries that they're about to bomb. But anyway, in this case, they ask, is it right for BuzzFeed to give anonymity to these Obama officials? Someone argued, I guess, oh, it's BuzzFeed editor Ben Smith says that actually it was a good thing he gave them anonymity to get them to run off at the mouth just so they could make that case about just how lawless people inside the U.S. national security state are. And what their attitudes toward the value of our lives are at this point. These people who supposedly are our security force, our protectors. So David Sirota at pandodaily.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Alright, do your show, Horton. Alright, okay. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. The website is scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. By the way, join up the chat room. I'm in there, but I had my window covered. Now it's on top here. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Join up and, you know, hang out with the guys. All right. So, yeah, it's the show. Did you watch the big award show last night? Yeah, me either. In fact, I had to turn off Twitter because I couldn't even look at Twitter without everybody talking about the stupid award show. Do people really care about that stuff? You listen to the songs they tell you to listen to and what have you? I don't get it. I couldn't see it, man. I don't even know the names of these pop stars. I don't know a single song by them, and I wish that all their cars had crashed, all their limousines on the way home from their crap. I even used to live in Hollywood. I still didn't know any of those people have anything to do with that crap. Who cares about that crap? They make, how many award shows can you have in a year for people who, you know, work in the entertainment industry? Wow, you guys are first place at entertaining people. We're doing another one of these in a week and a half. You'll have to get a brand new dress. It's going to be a real big deal. And I'm sorry, because I'm not supposed to just get up here and condemn what you love or whatever. But I don't understand it. I don't understand how you can stand it. All right. Anyway. So, hey, big news. The wife, a.k.a., she's actually her own person, Larissa Alexandrovna, award-winning investigative reporter, formerly with Raw Story. She's had some time off, but now she's back at work, and she's writing for the Progressive magazine. And that is progressive.org. And so you can find their press release kind of thing here. The Progressive hires former Raw Story investigative reporter Larissa Alexandrovna right here at on the front page of progressive.org. And then her first piece is called Welcome to the American Plutocracy. Isn't that great? So there you go. Larissa, the wife, back at it. She's... She made, you know, big waves back when in the Bush years. She was the first to break the story that Valerie Plame was working on Iran issues. She was the one, contra the Washington Post, who broke the story about the location of the CIA's torture camp in Poland. And, hell, man, she did stories about them attempting to plant weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and all kinds of stuff, man. I used to interview her all the time about her national security beat stuff. Oh, and then also she did the whole series, the permanent Republican majority, about all the political prosecutions in the South, Governor Siegelman of Alabama and associated forces and all of that. So a lot of great stuff there for Raw Story. And now she's writing for the Progressive. At least at first, I think she's going to be blogging there, and then we'll see how it goes. But I think it's going to be great. That's my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, writing for The Progressive, and proving, right, our household, the SNL crisis here, proving the Left Libertarian Alliance is doable. We don't have to agree on everything, and we don't. It's a good thing we don't have to, because then what would happen? No, we don't. She's left to me, and I'm a libertarian, which, you know, I'm a plumb line Anthony Gregorian, Sheldon Richmondian, so I'm neither left nor right at all. But I have believed for a very long time. In fact, my very first radio show I ever did back in 1998 on Free Radio Austin, I mean of my own show, I'd been guest on other people's shows in the past, but my very first show of my own on Free Radio Austin, 1998, I talk mostly about Waco, because it's so important that people understand the truth about that. But anyway, I had a little rant in there about how, you know, the political spectrum is better seen as an XY axis rather than just an X. And so instead of, you know, Stalin on the left and Hitler on the right, and you're supposed to find some happy medium in there somewhere. Yeah, I'm a moderate, you know, I'm a halfway between those. Instead, what we need is a better way of looking at it, with liberty on the top and totalitarian slavery at the bottom. And then we can, I think, it makes it easier to see the issues facing the American public and which ones are how important and what can be done. After all, if the bad guys, that is, you know, the statists, the war party, the national government and those who love it, all of its police agencies and its imperial forces and the rest, the IRS, if they can come together, say, for example, like the Democrats when they pass, or the Republicans when they pass an appropriations bill for the Democrats, as long as they get the terrible things that they want, they'll let the Democrats have the terrible things they want. I was going to bring up an older example when the American public, I mean, hell, why not? In 2006, the Democrats won both houses of Congress from the Republicans. Oh, no, I guess they'd had the Senate for a minute, right? Since Jeffers. But anyway, they won the House and they won a lot of seats in the Senate, and it was a clear anti-war mandate. So then when they were finally inaugurated and it was the new Congress under Nancy Pelosi in the House of Representatives, and they had their mandate to undo Bush's war in the spring of 2007, what'd they do? They gave him all the money he wanted. They had this ridiculous little benchmark thing, stupid, that never was enforced whatsoever and went away, and that was it. And they kept paying for the war ever since. And the deal at the time, it was actually widely reported at the time in very blatant terms that, yes, well, what happened was they bribed all of the Democratic members of Congress with pork barrel spending for their district. And they said, you have to vote for the war in order to get, you know, this money for your cronies. And then that was it. And the people who held out, they got more money until they quit holding out. And that was it. And they got it done. Well, if the left and the right in power can do that all the time, and we're going to bipartisan fashion to take us to war, to cancel our Bill of Rights, and to create a military police state in this country, then it seems like those of us on the outs of power ought to be able to work together, even when we disagree about very important things. We ought to be able to work together on the things that are the very most important things. And as I put it back then, on my very first show, you have good people on the left and good people on the right who really are anti-war and who really do put preserving the Bill of Rights for ourselves and for future generations at the top of their priorities and are willing to, if nothing else, never even mind compromise, just procrastinate and put off whatever divisive fight we have to have over the future of the welfare state until a little bit later, for example. Or the regulatory state. You know, I would like to get rid of every aspect of the government immediately. But how about we get rid of the empire, you know, the worst violence and the worst wasted money, and get rid of the police state, you know, outright injustice, the standing army among us that the founders wrote about in their Declaration of Independence from England, and, you know, work on some, you know, the most basic subjects of the violence our government uses in order to reorder our society all the time. Focus on ending the war on drugs, for example. Now, you can get not just a left libertarian alliance, but a left-right libertarian alliance around that. There are, you know, even William F. Buckley and the leaders of the conservative movement for generations have been for ending the war on drugs. You know, it's just your local demagogue who comes out against it. But everybody who's thought about it for a minute knows better than prohibition, which is stupid, which is horrible. You know, the only people who disagree with that are the job holders in the government who like collecting their checks and not having to have a real job for a living. But screw them. Big, strong, tough guy cops, let them go lift heavy things for a living and do something useful. Bale some hay or, you know, pull a cart or something. Anyway, so there you go. That's what I believe this whole time. I'm less idealistic than I was when I was a kid. I'm a bit more jaded. Back then, it was, you know, the Clinton years, and it was The right wing out of power sounded pretty libertarian for the most, well, for, you know, in some part. Especially, you know, the regular people who are among the rank and file of the right. Not so much, you know, Rush Limbaugh and them. They're pretty staunchly centrist Republican, but you know what I mean. The regular right-winger, you know, Rush listener. They could be pretty libertarian with Democrats or power back. Democrats are in power like they were back then, like they are again now. And anybody who was far enough to the left of Clinton that they hated Clinton because they saw him as a brown shirt fascist, well, they're a friend of mine. I mean, even though their economics are bad, they're going to definitely always be good on war and always be good on fair trials and torture and all the most important things like that 100% of the time. So I'll take it. I'll be friends with any communist who's always 100% against war and torture and jailing people without trial and that kind of thing. Come on. And then what happened was... Bush came into power, and all those right-wingers forgot they ever heard of the Constitution before for a single minute in their life. And liberals got really good for a while, made a lot of great alliances on the left. And then it's been much harder in the Obama years, as a lot of liberals like to pretend and progressives like to pretend things aren't as bad as they are. But you know, Matthew Rothschild over at the Progressive, he stayed good. And I think he's been a great example of how the left can stay good while the left is in power. And yeah, more realignment-y stuff like that with Steven Zunis right after this.
Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time?
Congratulations,
Larissa. Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott.
And I don't jest, cause the words I manifest, they will take you, sedate you. And I will stress upon you the need for you all to feed your minds and souls, so you can lead yourself to peace. I got a real objective here. I am effective here, cause I select a clear method for all. Suckers I maul, they fall and crawl into the pit of purgatory. I go for glory, I'm taking inventory, counting all the tough luck ducks.
Alright y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And speaking of left-right and libertarian realignment, I'm happy to welcome Steven Zunis back to the show. Steven, you are a professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Welcome back.
That's correct.
I don't know why I said that to you that way. Everyone, Steven is what I just said. And this article is at the National Catholic Reporter, The U.S. Role in Iraq's Upsurge in Violence. A great story, very well done piece here, and very timely. But, you know, first, before we get into the Iraq thing a little bit, I want to ask you about this left-right libertarian realignment. Mm-hmm. It's something that's been big in the news lately, you know, with the Edward Snowden revelations and all the controversy about that. And I know that, you know, you... aside from being an expert in America's horrible foreign policy, I was going to say American foreign policy, but I wanted to throw horrible in there.
You also are into activism itself and strategies for making things work. And so, you know, my idea, it's not original whatsoever, but basically it's just that where we have, say, you know, a consensus in D.C. of a liberal Republican like John McCain and a conservative Democrat like Barack Obama in the center, where to me, they're the real extremists. They're the ones who are for everything horrible, from NSA spying and militarizing the police to the overseas empire and all the rest of that. And then on the outside of power, we have all this room for a progressive, maybe more paleo-conservative and libertarian, with the libertarians in the center type of alliance against the war party and everything that it stands for. And, you know, it seems like with the emphasis more on decentralizing power, but especially, you know, with opposition to the empire and the atrocious, you know, destruction of the Bill of Rights going on right now as the first and foremost kind of priority. So I was wondering whether you can speak to that, whether you agree with me that that's, you know, really doable or workable, whether we maybe... maybe when we get off the topic of Iraq, you and I just have, and people as we would represent, just have too little in common on other issues, or what it is you think about that, and how we might move forward if you think that there's a way to move forward.
Well, yeah, I think every successful social movement has involved groups that have been willing to come together in areas where they agree and amicably go in different directions where they disagree. And that... I mean, I think there's certainly I would disagree on some libertarians and some economic issues and environmental issues and corporate power and things like that. I certainly share, for example, serious concerns about government intrusion on property rights. I certainly am concerned about getting ourselves involved in wars around the world and the incredible waste of our resources on that. I think it's interesting for a lot of people that it's important to work with people who may disagree with on some issues and issues where we come together. I mean, I'm very often attacked by members of the far left because I don't take a particular correct line on something, you know, and therefore I am the enemy. And I said, you know, no wonder the left in the United States is so marginalized when you end up attacking, you know, potential allies and getting to this kind of rigid sectarian kind of thing. So I do think that in areas of commonalities, people can come together. And I think on the very issues that you mentioned, that is about militarization and intervention and civil liberties, the various people who are often seen as being in very different places on the ideological spectrum. I think you put all of us together, we are the majority. And here, and these are areas where I think we can, we can come together and hopefully have a change of policy.
Well, and you know, the thing is too, at least from my point of view, and it, I guess it sounds a little bit naive, but in a way, conservatism, American conservatism, is about conserving at its very core, is about conserving classical liberalism. It's about conserving the gains of the American Revolution and the U.S. Constitution and preventing them from being, you know, completely trampled underfoot. And so, like, if you read the American Conservative magazine, I'm not sure what percentage of the entire conservative movement that magazine really speaks for, but of course, they've got great stuff about every aspect of American foreign policy and the U.S. government's relationship to the individual.
Accurate reflection of the American conservative tradition, even though by what the media and other people generally think of conservatives, they seem like more of an outlier group. But I think that the fact is that there's always been a contradiction between republic and empire, and in fact that was the big thrust that we saw over 100 years ago when the United States decided to conquer the Philippines, where where you also had a mixture of people coming together. The Anti-Imperialist League was formed that included a number of folks from across the political spectrum, included ordinary working class folks to leading intellectuals, including Mark Twain, who was their vice president, who asked this very question, what kind of nation are we? I mean, our founding revolution was against empire. So what are we doing becoming an imperial power ourselves and conquering the Philippines, especially since it cost so many thousands of American lives and our treasury in doing so?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of this is because of partisan politics, stuff just always stays mixed up and messed up. But it does seem like at least when it shifts back and forth, more and more people kind of wash out of the system's view of things and start to see things more independently. Hey, geez, these conservatives, whatever happened to keep big government off your back? Now all of a sudden we got a unitary executive with plenary power and all of this stuff. I mean? Mm-hmm. And liberals who, I really believe in Obama for about 6 months, and then what? This guy, he's just George W. Bush. And so then it comes to the consistent, whether left, right, or libertarian, but the consistent out of power who, are still good on the things that our politicians betray us on. It's how we win people over to this movement, I guess, And that is, I don't mean the libertarian one, but I mean the movement against empire and for the Bill of Rights.
Exactly.
Well, so now here's the thing that I think especially the right has a hard time getting over, and that is that you told them so about why not to invade Iraq. And, to think back to 11 years ago and the swagger and the hubris and, oh, hey, listen, for you to disagree at all is to question the might of America's military. And I know you're not calling America's military a sissy pants, are you? Well, good then. You have to support this war because our guys can do anything. And any questioning of the policy is a betrayal of each and every last soldier. So how dare you? And yet here we are in 2014. And I can tell you, I walk around the house having fantasies about tying George Bush to a chair and forcing him to just watch satellite feed of the continuing unfolding consequences of his war in the Middle East as people are being butchered to death from, Turkey to Yemen. You know what I mean? It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's out of control.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the upsurge of fighting in Iraq, people say, oh, it's this 1,400-year-old conflict between Sunni and Shia. That's just baloney. Sunni-Shia conflicts in the Middle East until recently were as a distant memory as the religious wars of Europe between Protestants and Catholics back in the 1600s. What happened when the United States, in Iraq you had intermarriage between Sunnis and Shias. That was quite common. If there was a small town with only one mosque, Sunnis and Shias worshiped together. There's less theological differences between Sunnis and Shias than there is between Catholics and Protestants. But what happened was that when the United States came in, they ended up abolishing the Iraqi army, which is not just the top officers, many of whom were war criminals that obviously deserve to get sacked and punished or whatever, but, a couple million of rank and file soldiers and engineer officers who were part of an institution that was long predated Saddam. We abolished that, and it was replaced by a bunch of sectarian militias. Meanwhile, we went to the bureaucracy, the civil service, and said, okay, if you're a member of the Ba'ath Party, you can't serve. Well, to be in the civil service, you had to be in the Ba'ath Party, whether or not you supported Saddam. So basically eliminated the civil service, and government agencies were replaced and they essentially became fiefdoms of various sectarian groups. And meanwhile, in getting the coalition government, the United States chose people based on their ethnic sectarian identification and kind of a divide-and-rule strategy like the colonial French did in Lebanon with similar results. Meanwhile, because Saddam was so good at oppressing everybody, the only institutions that could survive were those related to the Shia clerics. Now, one of the differences there are between Sunnis and Shias is that the Shias have a clear hierarchy. Ayatollah is sort of the equivalent of cardinals in the Catholic Church, and like cardinals and archbishops, they have a whole network of houses of worship and seminaries and hospitals and schools and things under their tutelage. So they could mobilize their folks where other elements of civil society could not. And so, surprise, no big surprise, they ended up winning the election, especially when U.S. suppression in the Sunni heartland ended up having the Sunnis boycott. So what happens is
Hold on. Slow down for just a second. We're gonna have a whole other segment. I want to let you tell the whole story here, but I want to make sure that people keep up that what happened was these Republicans came in, they abolished the entire state of Iraq, and then they didn't know, they had their plan to replace it, but when the Ayatollah said, hey, everybody, every Shiite Arab, if you believe in God, I want you to go outside and demand one man, one vote. They did, all of them. And the threat was, you'll have to start this war all over again against the people who stood by and cheered as you overthrew Saddam. So you don't want that, do you? And so, in other words, these Republicans had no idea what they were doing. They went and invaded this country, and if they had a plan, it was to let everything go to hell, and that worked. But I don't even think they were planning that well.
Apparently, George Bush didn't even know the difference between Sunni and Shia until 3 weeks before the invasion. So the crazy thing is that the two parties that have been dominating the country ever since, the Dawa and the Supreme Council of the Iraqi Revolution, Islamic Revolution in Iraq, spent their exile years in Iran.
Right. Dawa, now hold it right there. Let everybody chew on that during this very short commercial break. We'll be right back with Stephen Zunis. The article is The U.S. Role in Iraq's Upsurge in Violence. It's at ncronline.com, the National Catholic Report. It's really good. Go check it out. We'll be right back. Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Stephen Zunis. This article, his latest in the National Catholic Reporter, is called The U.S. Role in Iraq's Upsurge in Violence. And, well, that's the headline, but it's, you know, the story of how the U.S. invasion of 2003 just sowed widespread chaos. It's the story of since then, what happened, how it happened. And it's really good. And where we left off, the American neoconservatives had no idea what the hell they were doing, and neither did their dear leader. And they blundered into this thing. And then by January 2005, the Dawa Party, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, sorry, there was supposed to be an and between those, who had been exiled in Iran for 30 years since Jimmy Carter had Saddam invade them in the first place. These were the Iraqi traitors. These were the guys who came in on the heels of the invasion and that the Americans put in power. And so then that brings us up to 2005. And then, so, gee, what was it that got hundreds of thousands of people killed after that, Stephen?
Yeah, well, it was a number of things. You know, one was that for many Sunni Iraqis, they saw, wow, we have a government now that's made up of our two historic enemies, the Persians, the Iranians, and the Western imperialists, that is the United States and Britain. And so there are some extremists among them who then started, you know, in fact, well, since the Shia population elected these guys, they're at fault. And so some of the extremists, the al-Qaeda types, ended up sending up bombs and attacking the Shia civilians. And then in retaliation, the U.S.-backed government in the manner of El Salvador in the 80s sent out these death squads and started massacring random Sunni men. And so then people who were not sectarian-oriented ended up embracing some of these militias in self-defense because, you know, the government and the U.S. Troops weren't protecting them. And the thing just kind of spiraled out of control. So in other words, it's not that they're fighting over their sectarian differences. And it's kind of like the Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. They weren't fighting each other because they were about religion, per se. It was that the Catholics, for various historical reasons, identified as Irish nationalists, and the Protestants, for various historical reasons, identified as British unionists. But that didn't stop extremists on both sides from planting bombs in the pubs that were frequented by the other.
Right.
And this is kind of what happened in Iraq. And then, of course,
let me stop you there just to emphasize how important that is, that, you know, this theory that it's supposedly, I mean, nobody ever proved it, but it's just the assumption underlying so much of the debate about what goes on in the Middle East is that, well, as long as the Shia and the Sunni believe different from each other, they're just going to always keep killing each other over the differences in their beliefs, when that's not what it is. It's just factions defined by religious belief at war. And so these things, it's always human politics, land and money and power and influence, right?
Exactly. And it was the classic divide and rule. And of course, even though those of us who opposed the invasions warned this could provoke sectarian conflict, it was a sectarian conflict that then gave the Bush administration the excuse to keep troops in and actually increase troops there. Of course, that gave even more support to the various sectarian militias. Now, what's happened more recently is that U.S.-backed, Shia sectarian government, despite being sort of elected, is incredibly corrupt and autocratic. I mean, they routinely massacre civilians. In fact, interesting little backstory here. What motivated Bradley Manning to release the to do his WikiLeaks things was when he was ordered to be part of to support this operation where the U.S. would help the Iraqi police or Iraqi death squad basically kill a couple journalists who were exposing corruption on the part of the government. And he was saying, hey, is this really the thing that U.S. troops should be engaged in? And he was told to shut up about it. And that's what really finally motivated him to upload all the material and the rest of history. But this is the kind of thing that this government's been continuing to do when they had pro-democracy protests and they had anti-corruption protests. People have been shot and beaten. The offensive by al-Qaeda, which had took over parts of Ramadi and still control a good chunk of Fallujah, happened right after the Iraqi police and armed forces violently broke up a peaceful protest encampment, killing a number of people. And this is like the fifth such nonviolent encampment that the regime has attacked and killed people in. And so they're saying, and of course that gave emphasis to saying, see, the government is just kills if you're peaceful. You have to pick up arms. Da da da. And now, of course, the United States is using this as an excuse to increase our military aid to the repressive Baghdad regime. And, you know, and the cycle continues.
Yeah, well, and they're even going, probably already they're there training Iraqi soldiers in Jordan, they say, which at least in Jordan. But, man, here we go again, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Saddam Hussein was incredibly brutal and repressive, but, you know, he was pretty much an equal opportunity oppressor, at least among the Arab population. And again, the sectarian thing is not something in Iraq history. It is very much an outgrowth of U.S. policy.
I think, you know, they might remember, and it might bother them, that they told us for a year straight, look, we want a regime change, and here's a bunch of excuses, most of them scary weapons that could poison or blow you out to death, and so you have to let us do this. It's an emergency. It's the greatest threat on the face of the planet. He could give these weapons to terrorists. And then after 2 days in Iraq, they says, oh, yeah, no, the reason we're doing this is because Saddam's a torturer and we're liberating the people of Iraq. And then they got how many hundreds of thousands? Somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people killed, somewhere right around in there, give or take the remainder, because nobody really knows or knows how to count that many dead people. And all to what? Give them a regime of torturers. Great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. And this is also, I mean, on the one hand, you know, if I was living in Fallujah and the black flag of Al-Qaeda was flying in my neighborhood and those guys were enforcing these draconian laws, you know, I'd want to be liberated. But on the other hand, we've seen how regimes like that of Iraq and have liberated cities, usually by bombing the bejesus out of entire neighborhoods.
Well, and that's what's going on right now.
They made in USA on all the bomb casings and everything else, and they'll just encourage, you know, more radicalism and extremism.
Right. I mean, at antiwar.com right now, it says news.antiwar.com, Iraq pounds Fallujah with airstrikes, artillery. Well, yeah, that's a good way to hunt down Al-Qaeda, huh?
Yeah, really. And in Fallujah, and one reason the two U.S. assaults in that city were so tragic is that it is in Iraqi history, it has a strong symbolic importance as a sort of a coming together of the various tribes of a sense of national identity and the like, and to have that kind of assault on a regime that most people in that, at least in that part of Iraq, see as illegitimate, and again backed by the United States, it's just going to harden attitudes. It's going to make things worse.
Is it too soon to question whether Eastern Iraq, Western Anbar Province, Iraq, will end up just combining with rebel parts of Syria, and we'll have a new Islamo-fascist caliphate there, just like George Bush always wanted, or always pretended he was defending us from?
Yeah, I think most Sunni Arabs, even those who are devoutly religious and even those who are very much opposed to the regime and to U.S. policies, don't identify with Al-Qaeda because those guys are just, again, too extreme, too hardcore, you know, apocalyptic in their ideology and genocidal in their methods.
The government of Baghdad isn't really the government of the Anbar province, is it? It's just sort of
at it. Very few people identify and support it, and all the deals that they made that say, if you lay down your arms and cooperate with us, the Americans, we'll give you a role in government, we'll give you jobs, and incorporate you into the army. They have fulfilled a few of those things, but most of them have not. And so the tribes there are quite bitter. Meanwhile, you have this porous border with Syria, and in fact, we're really freaked out, saying, "Oh, we must arm the moderate opposition in Syria to counter the extremist opposition." Well, how would that extremist come about? They're a direct outgrowth of the extremists in Iraq, which were not did not exist until the U.S. ended up invading and occupying that country. There would not be such a disproportionate amount of a hardline extremist among the Syrian opposition. Again, if it weren't for the training and organization and everything that grew out of the U.S. occupation, because for a lot of people in the Middle East, especially these hardline Islamists, they don't recognize these artificial colonial borders that demarcates Iraq and Syria. Those were drawn by the British and French. That had nothing to do with them or their culture or whatever. So, you know, if they're fighting what they see as an illegitimate government, Damascus or Baghdad, doesn't matter to them. And so, you know, it's all one struggle to them. And again, so I think this is most of the faults of the horrible things going on in Syria is the Assad regime itself. Here too, I think you can make a case that the United States has contributed to the carnage and to why it's become such a magnet of the extremists.
And I got the idea that you and I are going to be talking about the consequences of the Iraq war as they play out for years to come, too, Stephen. It's hardly over yet, but we're all out of time. Thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Sure thing.
All right, but that is Stephen Zunis from the University of San Francisco. His article at the National Catholic Reporter is The U.S. Role in Iraq's Upsurge in Violence. It's at ncronline.org.
You're listening to the only 24-hour libertarian news and talk station. Climb aboard the Liberty Express.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Ukraine's justice minister says if anti-government protesters do not leave the justice ministry, she'll ask for a state of emergency to be imposed. Protesters seized the building late on Sunday and set up barricades outside. After clashes with authorities, protests have spread, with activists taking over buildings in about 10 cities across the country. Tom Barton reports from Moscow.
Protests started 2 months ago with President Viktor Yanukovych's refusal to sign a trade and reform deal with the European Union under heavy Russian pressure. They escalated with the rushing through Parliament of sweeping anti-protest laws and the deaths of four protesters in recent days. The unopposed occupation of the Justice Ministry was a symbolic act, say activists, and they will not use it for hooliganism. Although protests have been largely peaceful, a small hardcore of activists have been throwing stones and firebombs at police, who have been responding with plastic bullets and stun grenades. The Justice Minister says she will ask for negotiations with the opposition to be stopped unless the ministry is vacated without delay. Tom Barton, Moscow.
Syrian peace talks in Geneva are focusing on wider political questions, such as the issue of transfer of power in the country. Discussions also continue in Geneva on aid convoys reaching besieged areas in the city of Homs. On Sunday, the Syrian government delegation said women and children would be allowed to leave the city, but asked for a list of names of men who wanted to leave. Some opposition delegates have expressed reservations over those conditions. China's Jade Rabbit moon rover is in trouble after experiencing a mechanical control abnormality, according to state media. The moon exploration vehicle ran into problems because of the moon's complicated lunar surface environment, according to Xinhua News Agency. The rover landed in December as part of China's mission, the first soft landing on the moon since 1976, and it was expected to operate for around 3 months. If Scotland becomes an independent country, a separate coronation for a future monarch may be needed, according to leading academics. Scots will take to the polls later this year and vote on whether to remain part of the United Kingdom. UK correspondent Natalie Feary reports.
If Scotland becomes independent, its parliament would be separate, but the Queen would remain the head of state. The Church of Scotland has asked for separate English and Scottish coronation ceremonies if Scotland leaves the UK. And academics Dr. Karen Bowie and Dr. Claire Jackson believe this may be necessary, based on historical precedents. Before the Act of Union in 1707, Scotland and England had separate parliaments. During this time, monarchs either also had coronations in Scotland or took Scottish coronation oaths in London. Natalie Feary, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. Special Representative to North Korea Glyn Davis is to lead an American delegation to Japan, China and South Korea for talks on North Korea. Recently, the North has been issuing threatening statements about the upcoming U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises. Priscilla Huff reports from Washington.
Policy on North Korea tops the agenda for U.S. Special Representative Glyn Davis and his team of American diplomats as they travel to China, South Korea, and Japan. Recently, North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations issued a proposal that immediately and unconditionally all military and hostile acts targeting fellow countrymen in collusion with outsiders should be halted. He was referring to the upcoming annual military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea. This follows a letter to South Korea from North Korea's National Defense Commission saying it wants to create an atmosphere of reconciliation and unity. That said, Washington and its ally in Seoul want to see action by Pyongyang, not just words.
California continues to experience a record-breaking dry spell, officially in the grip of a drought. It's impacting agriculture and food prices, bringing bears out of hibernation and stoking wildfires. Low water levels at one lake have exposed the remains of a mining town from the Gold Rush era. Rebecca Bowering reports.
Receding waters at Folsom Lake in Northern California have revealed remnants of the town of Mormon Island. In the 1850s, it was home to 2,500 people, 4 hotels and 7 saloons. The town was flooded in the 50s when a dam was built. California's in the midst of a drought that's being called the worst on record. The snowpack in the Sierra Nevada mountains is at 20% of its normal volume. Just over a week ago, Governor Jerry Brown formally announced a drought emergency and called on everyone across the state to save water.
Rebecca Bowering, San Francisco.
And that's the latest feature story news. Ollie Barrett reporting.
This is Liberty Express, your home for economics from a free market perspective.
You're listening to Liberty Express Radio. If you want to know more about any of the shows that broadcast on our network, simply click on the picture of the show's host, and you'll be directed to their homepage. This will give you immediate access to all the resources available for that show. Thank you for listening.
Y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up on the show, Eric Margolies will be here to talk about what's going on in Ukraine. And I know it's far away, but it involves you, sort of, kind of, because the money they took right out of your paycheck went to go muck around in Ukraine, of course. Come on, did you think that there was a thing that wasn't a CIA plot? Everything's a CIA plot, especially a mob of people with a color out in the street demanding that the election they just lost be overturned in favor of a pro-NATO somebody. I think I might have seen that one before. In Ukraine, actually, yeah. Oh, no, in this case, they're fighting over a trade agreement. It's not an election, but anyway, it's obviously a color-coded type of a U.S. aid, National Endowment for Democracy, CIA type of a screw job, and hopefully we'll be learning just how bad from Eric Margolies. You know, not like the people of Ukraine aren't people with their own agendas and all of that, but my interest is in my government's interest, if you know what I mean. So, let's talk about Somalia. I got to talk about Somalia. All right, look, so I want to see if I can make it simple, because sometimes I can go on and on, and I don't want to go on and on. I want to make it compelling for you, so let's see if I can just break down American intervention in Somalia in stages. After 2001 and the September 11th attack, the Republicans, the Bush White House, their national security state on their authority, they decided that they wanted to hunt down some Somalis who were alleged to have been involved in the attacks on the African embassies. I forget, perhaps, and or the USS Cole attack. Okay, so previous Al-Qaeda attacks on American targets. And so what happened was they started paying off warlords to hunt down and kill these, Islamists, the bad guys and their friends. And so what ended up happening, of course, was I don't know if they ever handed over a single actual wanted individual to the FBI. Maybe there were a couple, but mostly what they did was the warlords just hunted down and killed whoever were their enemies. And, you know, maybe whoever they could tell the Americans, yeah, this guy was an Islamist, so we took care of him for you and all that.
But, you know, the Americans, of course, didn't care. They may have known, they may not even have cared to know, that the people of Somalia had, basically the warlords had exhausted themselves. And the people of Somalia were basically free of their rule. They had not all come together and decided to create an anarcho-capitalist society. They just sort of got one by default because the last of their warlords were basically Chapter 11 and had been so limited in their authority. They were just, you know, highwaymen here or there, but that was about it. Low-level banditry compared to what they had been. And so when the CIA came in and started backing these guys, the people of Somalia were pissed off about it because, you know, they were murderers. And so people started fighting back against it. And then, so I guess stage two would be, oh, so you're going to fight back, huh? Well, that's the first thing that ever happened in the world. So now we have to back these warlords even more because apparently there's a real threat from these Islamists here. That is, anyone who dares resist the warlords. And so the CIA escalated their support. And so then finally, the people of Somalia came together, or at least that's overly broad, 13 disparate groups of people from across Somalia came together and formed the Islamic Courts Union. They had a pretty broad mandate. And the Islamic Courts Union's mandate was to just kick the warlords the hell out of the country. And so they did. They defeated them and drove them over the line into Ethiopia. And then at that point, the Americans got pissed off. And, you know, the Islamic Courts Union was in charge. And they tried to pretend that these guys were the Taliban reincarnate, which hardly was true. I mean, Somali society is just not cut out for that kind of thing. It, you know, they were Islamists, but the Americans could have just as easily dealt with them as not, is the point. Hey, they tried to deal with the Taliban. It's not like they cared, you know, if people get thrown down the well or not. What do they care about that? They throw people down the well themselves. So anyway, Christmas 2006, the Americans got the Ethiopians to invade and overthrow the Islamic Courts Union. And at that point, and of course they did. I mean, they just destroyed it. They rolled in there. And then there was a campaign of horrible war crimes under the Ethiopians, you know, their historic rivals, Christians versus Somalia's Muslims. And they've already got bad history going back, you know, who knows how far, the whole time, I guess. And so there were rapes and murders and cutthroats and massacres. And it was a really horrible thing. And but the smallest and least powerful part of the Islamic Courts Union, stage three, I guess, they were, the reason they were the most marginal group is because they were the youth. And so the Islamic Courts Union had been the old men. And, but the old men can't fight. The youth are the ones who fight. And so they succeeded in actually driving the Ethiopian army out of the country by 2008. And then by then, the Bush administration was out of time. So Condoleezza Rice cut a deal and put Sheikh Sharif, who they had invaded to overthrow in the first place, put him back in power. And then as Jeremy Scahill writes on page 222 of his book, Dirty Wars, that the movie is based on, the State Department at least claimed that that was their plan all along, was to go ahead and keep Sheikh Sharif. They just want to take him down a peg or two. What? By having the Ethiopians invade the country and kill tens of thousands of people? And then here's the kicker, too, is the rains didn't come. And for 2 or 3 years there in the Horn of Africa, there was a massive famine, but especially in Somalia, war-torn Somalia, where all of the means of distribution of food, all of the literal markets and the figurative market processes were completely broken down. And so anyone who had even been able to turn a crop in the midst of all the crisis didn't have a way to get it to anyone, and they didn't have any money to buy it anyway. And so because of America's war, a quarter of a million Somalis died in that famine. Most of them women and children. Most of them children under 5 years old. And that was the Americans and the American and British government studies that determined that, by the way. Hang on, I got a cough really bad.
And, man, sorry. That was FuseNet. FuseNet. They are a non-governmental organization paid for by the U.S. and British governments. And that's their survey of the damage done from the famine of 2011. That's what they call it. It actually started before that. And many would have died anyway. But, guys, they were dying in refugee camps, and they were in refugee camps because of what America had done to them. They were dying on the side of the road, not at home, where, you know, maybe if they had still been able to be at their house, they could have had a little bit of a garden with some radishes or something. No, nothing, nothing. Again, as per the Ledeen Doctrine, America's got to take a crappy little country that couldn't possibly resist and slam it against the wall every once in a while just to show we mean business. Because nothing says tough guy like being Michael Ledeen, the soft-handed bookworm fascist. Never been in a fight in his life, certainly never won one. And picking on the smallest, weakest, crappiest little civilization that ever existed on the planet. No offense, Somalis. I mean, you may have a glorious history from back before colonialism or something. I don't know. What do I know? But right now, Somalia, you couldn't find a more pathetic band of people and call them a nation. And then have the most powerful state in the history of mankind, the American Empire, just go ahead and take it out on them for fun. Because they can't do nothing. And then, so, now, the youth, Boko Haram, that rose up to, who had no power, who were the least influential part of the Islamic Courts Union, who rose up to overthrow the Ethiopians, they're still fighting. And the Americans are now paying the Ethiopians who have reinvaded, as well as the Ugandans and the Kenyans and the Burundians under the auspices of the African Union to occupy Somalia. And yet Al-Shabaab just keeps, and maybe yet isn't the right term, and Al-Shabaab continues to grow and is more internationalized now than ever, as Francis Nesbitt explained on the show a few months back, because when the Kenyans kicked them out of the port of Kismayo, they needed money quick. They weren't able to export charcoal anymore, so their revenue was cut off. So what'd they do? They went to the Saudis, who said, yeah, we'll give you some money if you'll blow up targets on an international basis. So you can call that, and now we got drone attacks going off over there. Call this stage 6 or 7 of America and the damned there in Somalia.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com.
Oh, man, I said Boko Haram when I meant Al-Shabaab. Bill called me out. Thanks, Bill. I didn't even hear myself say it wrong either. You're 100% right. Early onset dementia, he says. Yeah, you probably got that right too, bud.
In the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours. They're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's TONX.org/liberty.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com.
Such a damn, my hometown. You know, another land.
Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Eric Margulies is coming up here in a minute. Man, I'm sorry I said Boko Haram when I meant Al-Shabaab. That's the other fake enemy on the other side of the continent there in Nigeria. Yeah, America's doubling down in Nigeria, too. Did I mention that? I mentioned that on a show last week, right? There was a news story about that. And, oh, yeah, because I was complaining. I've been predicting that since 2007, so it almost doesn't count anymore. I was way too far ahead of the curve, but yeah, Boko Haram, they'll suffice for an enemy. Don't you want to die on the Nigerian Delta in a Swift boat? Oh, the new Swift boats, man. The 2014 model Swift boats by Lockheed. They're awesome. I'll tell you what, we'll sell them to you. Only to you. Don't tell anybody. But for you, $50 million a piece. Right? Yeah, all right. Anyway. So thanks for listening to the show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is scotthorton.org. And also, you can like me on Facebook at /Scott Horton Show. You can follow me on Twitter at /Scott Horton Show. And you can subscribe to me on YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. If you like doing those things. So now, again here, real quick. U.S. drone strike kills 5 in Somalia, including key al-Shabaab leader. And this is by Jason Ditson. He says that it appears that actually they could have been trying to kill this other guy, and they're patting themselves on the back for half credit for killing another guy. But anyway, remember now that we talked about this on January the 10th. The New York Times, U.S. advisors sent to help Somalia fight the Shabaab. Al-Shabaab, that weakest, smallest faction of the young, of the 13 groups of the Islamic Courts Union, they were the tag-alongs until the Bush administration had the Ethiopians invade, and then they grew up overthrowing the Ethiopians and forcing them out, at least temporarily, for a few years. And their insurgency continues to grow. And so now, according to the New York Times, and they're lying here when they say this is the first time since 1993, Jeremy Scahill's already documented the presence of the Joint Special Operations Command in Somalia. We know CIA's been there, so to leave out the fact that we know CIA's been there is already a lie. And then it would seem to me like they would have to contradict Scahill's reporting where he says the JSOC is there if they're going to sit here and tell us that this is the first time the military has put boots on the ground there since 1993 in the Black Hawk Down mission. But anyway, here they go. They say, oh, 3 advisors. For now. At least for now. That's the New York Times version. Remember this for history, everybody. History just began yesterday in Somalia. You don't need to know anything that led up to this moment at all. All you need to know is 3 advisors, quote, at least for now. And you know, the truth is, I mean, they don't have to do it, so I guess they don't have to do it. In fact, my gut is kind of telling me, and my gut's really smart, I think. My brain thinks my gut's smart. I don't know if anybody else would agree. But I kind of think that they're actually not going to escalate too much further, because what's the point? I mean, if Obama got hell-bent about it and sent the entire Marine Corps, could they wipe out every fighting-age male in Somalia? Yeah, I guess they could. But are they that determined to do so? Do they really care either way? I mean, they've got Mogadishu, for now at least. Seems like they got a pretty good hold on Mogadishu, America's sock puppets, that is. I guess maybe this is the reaction to the attack at the mall in Nairobi, Kenya, which, again, Kenya invaded Somalia and has put troops in Somalia before al-Shabaab ever attacked, which, of course, they attacked a shopping mall and murdered civilians because they are bin Ladenite, crazy civilian butchering terrorists. They're horrible guys, but I'm just saying whose fault that is. Uncle Sam. What a great character. Whoever came up with that, Uncle Sam, he's tough, but he loves you, man. He's going to take real good care of you. real good. That should win the prize for all-time best marketing crap right there. Ever made people believe things that ain't true. Uncle Sam. Alright, so, yeah, Somalia. You know, I don't know. I'm torn because I know nobody cares, but on the other hand, that's why I talk about it, because nobody cares. Really, I'm not torn about it. I don't care if you don't care. I care. I want you to care about this Somalia thing. You know, if it was just that, hey, man, there's a bad thing going on in the world somewhere, then okay, boo-hoo, cry me a river. If you feel that way, then I guess I could understand that. But this is America's fault, man. And I'm not a collectivist. This is America's government's fault. This is CIA's fault. This is the military's fault. This is the every other alphabet agency and the elected jerks and the appointees and whoever that run them all up there and confirm them and ratify them and carry these things out and let them walk out of hearing rooms without being arrested. And them, they did it. The U.S. state did it. Hundreds of thousands of Somalis dead because of the American Empire. So somebody should have to face up for that, you know? I don't know. I sort of feel like for my part, what can I do other than try to tell you about it? That's my role. That's how I get to make up for it, is by going, hey, don't let them get away with killing all these people and don't even notice. Don't even notice? Come on. Take out 10 minutes to notice that your government is the one who ruined all those Somalis to death. More than you could count. Most of them little bitty kids. According to the U.S. government. Anyway. All right. Good. And then so. Let me talk about the Snowden spy thing. Here's my only point about the Snowden spy thing. There's no proof at all. There's even a new book out. And one of these, liberal turncoat guys, I don't know who this guy is, Tom Watson. Apparently liberals believe in this guy or listen to him or read the things he writes or something. I've never heard of him before. But supposedly he's supposed to be some big shot, Democrat, liberal, thinker, writer guy. And so he's piling on against Ed Snowden. And I read his review on Amazon.com of this new book accusing Ed Snowden of being a spy. And his review basically amounts to, I would love to believe this so bad, but I'm afraid this book doesn't quite make the case. So there's a guy who would love to believe it so bad, who's been pushing these rumors as much as he can on behalf of the Obama administration against Edward Snowden. And that's all I know about the book, really, but I mean, there you go. Guy wrote a whole book about it, and all he's got is, well, I think the Russians must have helped Edward Snowden do it. Derp. But so here's the real point. How many Americans believe that? How many Americans have heard their, face it, mostly right-wing echo chamber media, the same liars who lied you into war with Iraq on your talk radio stations, saying, oh, Snowden spy, Snowden spy. Yeah, Russians. Is that taking? Are people buying into that? Not a shred of evidence. You got Republican hack congressmen saying, well, it must be, I think, because. And how much of the American media is willing to just completely, they don't care at all. They just repeat it like nothing. And not challenge the people making the claims. And yet, still, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. And, come on, man. Be honest with yourselves. Never mind the liars, but I mean the people who believe the lies. Come on. Is that what this sounds like to you? That really? Snowden, all this stuff about leaking and civil liberties and the Bill of Rights and giving it to Glenn Greenwald because he knows what a principled writer Glenn Greenwald is and all this. All that is just a smokescreen for giving the NSA stuff to the Russians. I mean, who's buying that? I don't mean to even accuse anybody of being so stupid as to believe that. I mean, clearly there are liars trying to make people believe that, but my question is anybody buying that? And if you are buying that, does it matter to you that they have no evidence of that?
And do you really believe that all this civil liberty stuff is just a smokescreen? I mean, I could even see the argument that I don't like this Snowden guy, and I wish that he hadn't blown this whistle. I'm not saying I agree with that whatsoever. But I'm just saying, if you come from that point of view, still, that doesn't mean that he's not trying to do the right thing, even if it's in a way that you disagree with. But all the stuff about him being a Russian spy, I don't know. To me, the most important thing out of it is just what tools the news anchors on TV are, that they're willing to let government officials get away with that crap. I don't know. And by the way, speaking of Edward Snowden, the Germans interviewed him for half an hour. I post on my blog at Facebook, ScottHorton.org/stress. ScottHorton.org/stress. And it's half an hour long. I didn't get a chance to finish it. I'm about 10 minutes into it, but it's really good. It's the first time, I mean, I guess Laura Poitras is making a documentary film about him, but I don't know when we're ever going to see that freaking thing. But anyway, so finally, here's a good half hour sit-down interview with Edward Snowden. It begins with the guy asking him about these threats on his life from government officials. No treason trial for you, dude. Just a hood in a torture dungeon in Poland. Well, you see, it was a Nazi base. Originally constructed by the Nazis, it was inherited by Joseph Stalin, who turned it into a communist gulag, and only then, as my wife reported first, it was turned into a torture dungeon for the CIA there. Torture you to death, and that'll be the end of you. It's good. You should look at it. It's LiveLeak.com has it. German television does first Edward Snowden interview. And it's all in English and everything, so go check it out. It's on my website, scholar.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Anti-imperialism is at the center of libertarianism, as long as we keep it that way. So if you're part of a libertarian group, how about having me out to give a talk on the wars? I work cheap, and I'm good on everything. I've even been known to change a mind or two with some of these things. Check out some examples at scotthorton.org/speeches, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more information. By the way, this February 15th, the Future Freedom Foundation is having John Glazer and I give a talk at the International Students for Liberty Conference in Washington. Come on out and say hi. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it, but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And next up is our friend Eric Margolese. He's the author of the books War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And his website is ericmargolese.com, spelled like Margolis, ericmargolese.com. And also he writes for unz.com, that's UNZ.com. And LouRockwell.com. You can find all this stuff. Great archive at LRC there. LouRockwell.com. Welcome back to the show. Eric, how are you doing?
Frozen solid, Scott. Thank you.
Yeah, now, you live up there in Canada there temporarily. You're a true-blooded, red-blooded American, but just you're some kind of expat. What's up with that?
Yeah, I'm not. I don't consider myself an American. I consider myself a New Yorker. because I was born in Manhattan. And
a Manhattan nationalist you are.
I'm a Manhattan. I'm a rare. I'm an endangered species, a Manhattan-born person who is still alive and cooking. But I come to Canada often because I've had I write for Canadian Medium. My wife is a Canadian. And we're up here now, and this damned Arctic vortex is freezing us out now for months.
And now, how cold is it there, really?
Well, it's about, with the wind chill, it's about 23 or 24 below zero Fahrenheit today.
Wow. Well, it's beautiful here in Austin, you should know.
It's always beautiful in Austin.
Mostly, yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah, I don't know. July and August, September, it can get pretty.
True enough. Okay.
Yeah, no, we got a little bit of ice the other day, which is a special treat for me. It counts as snow. It counts as like 2 feet of snow in a veritable winter wonderland, but it's we got to grade it on a curve when you're from here, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Hey, listen, I'm really glad that you wrote this article about Ukraine. It's right here at the UNZ Review, UNZ.com. Don't let Kiev become another Sarajevo. And you're not talking about 1990s Sarajevo. You're talking about 19-teens Sarajevo.
That's right.
Let's not have a world war. I buy your premise. Let's not have a world war. But so now take me through your argument.
Well, as a historian, I have a Swiss degree in pre-World War I diplomatic history. I am very sensitive to the march of events that led up to World War I, where we're right at this fall will be the 100th anniversary of that catastrophe. And I see very similar elements happening here with declining empires, rising empires, and all kinds of arrogance and false assumptions. The situation in Ukraine is very difficult. Ukraine is splintering to Western-looking Ukraine, to Eastern-looking Ukraine, essentially Westernized versus Russianized Ukraine, which was almost an unnatural country, or its borders were unnatural to begin with because they were moved around so much by Stalin. But it's dangerous because there's great violence in Kiev, the capital, and spreading to other Ukrainian cities. And there are threats of civil war. And as I wrote in my article, beyond that, there's a threat of possible intervention.
All right, and now, so talk a little bit about the Sunni-Shia split there. I guess it's the Orthodox and the Catholic and the Russian and the Western there. I'm oversimplifying. Help me out.
Well, I'm not sure thank goodness that religion is not playing a predominant role in this crisis. The West tends to be Catholic. The East is certainly Orthodox. There's no love lost between those two. But Ukraine's history weighs very heavily on the whole subject. I mean, you have to go back to the 30s when Stalin murdered between 6 and 11 million Ukrainians. It's called the Holodomor. It's the forgotten Holocaust. Mm. It happened in 1933-34. While the world watched on and did nothing. And we, Americans, were allied to the perpetrator of this monstrous crime during World War II, the Soviet Union. So Ukraine's never recovered from that. They were battling. The Ukrainians were daggers drawn with the Poles in the West. In the East, they were sort of marooned. The real problem, Scott, is that while the Western Ukraine wants to join the EU, Eastern Ukraine is the industrialized portion of Ukraine. Very heavy industry, Donetsk Basin with coal, steel, heavy industry, petrochemicals. That was really part of the old Soviet economy and still today sells its products to Russia. If Ukraine were to join intact with the EU, We've seen it over and over. We saw it in East Germany, for example, where all the local industry, the minute East Germany joined West Germany, just collapsed. And that would happen in Ukraine, putting all these companies out of business that are very politically influential and causing great unemployment. So before integration with the West can boost employment, so people are frightened, and that's really at the basis of the problem.
All right, and so and what's the big deal about this EU trade agreement? Because they already have an EU trade agreement of some kind, right? So is this a, some real big step of bringing them into NATO or the EU or something like that? Or
well,
it's just kind of symbolically that?
It was the first step of NATO expansion. And it looked at dropping tariffs and sort of bringing Ukraine into the EU economy, which is no great shakes these days either. But, you know, it's funny, the EU says, oh, no, we have no room for the Turks. But we are sure we can take 40 million Ukrainians or 49 million, whatever there are.
Yeah.
They're white people and they're Christians, and that's okay. But it was integration into Europe. The Russians saw it as a disguised membership in the EU. It was just delayed, slow-motion membership. And remember that when Gorbachev refused, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the Kremlin was assured by Washington and London that it would not push NATO's borders, the NATO up to Russia's borders. Mm-hmm. Gorbachev was assured of this. And in return, he said, okay, we will let the Soviet Union collapse. We won't use military force to keep it. And in fact, what happened, Gorbachev kept his word, but Washington did not. And now NATO, read the United States, is relentlessly pushing its presence right up to Russia's borders, both in the Baltic, now in Central Europe, and in the Caucasus.
And now, so, okay, now we got the protesters in the street, and they're representing, do they represent the other party that's out of power right now? Or don't tell me they're protesting that badly for a trade deal, or they're just there against, this is their opportunity to oppose Yanukovych, I can't say it right.
Yeah, no, that's right. This dispute has been going on for a long time. There were two warring camps. Remember the Orange Revolution?
Sure, in 2004.
That we quietly financed from the United States. There are these Western-looking, a lot of them younger people, who have now turned their allegiance to the, call them the revolutionary leaders in Kiev. They hate Yanukovych, and they hate the Ukrainian old guard of big corrupt industrialists and secret police, and they don't like the pro-Russian attitude. So that's been going on and on and on. But in the meantime, you have, first of all, the mainstream Ukrainian opposition. Then on top of that, you've got another party, and then you've got a bunch of right-wing militants who are also joining in the rioting and things. And so there's a wide ideological diversity there, and there are a very strong right-wing underground in Ukraine that's bitterly anti-Russian.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see why, but...
Well, right. You know, it's like Poland, where the Poles couldn't wait to get as far away as they could from Russia. Who can blame them? But the
To be stuck right next to them anyway.
They are, but they want NATO's protective mantle, right. And so do the Western Ukrainians. They're worried. They want to get away from Mother Russia, whereas the Eastern Ukrainians want to cozy up even more to Russia. I mean, they are Russians.
Mm-hmm. Well, so then. Well, obviously, a couple things. First of all, is this just the sequel, and this is the CIA and the NED and USAID and whatever, you know, cutout groups, George Soros groups or whatever, financing another fake Orange Revolution? Or is this something more or less than that? And then I guess you end the essay questioning about, you know, the future of Ukraine as a state at all, never mind admission to NATO.
It's we, the United States, Britain in particular, have been stirring the pot. There's no doubt about it. We're using these techniques developed during the original Orange Revolution, later used in Iran, to stir up crowds through social media, spreading money around, broadcasts. It's a very effective crowd-arousing technique. We are doing it, but that shouldn't cover the fact that there's a genuine urgency and demand by these Ukrainians to overthrow the corrupt Yanukovych government, which came to power through kind of rigged elections and fraud. The problem is that the Ukrainian opposition has split leadership and will probably fall to fighting amongst themselves should they ever gain power, not to mention fighting against the eastern Ukraine, which is supporting the government.
Well, I mean, if there's a silver lining to this, it's that the turmoil means they can't join NATO like this, right? Everything's got to be nice and settled before they can join the alliance.
Scott, I'll tell you what really worries me is I was writing my column about this, and it's hard writing a column about this because it's such a complex situation. And whenever you write about something like this, you know, I got hundreds of angry people emailing me, how dare you say X, Y, and Z, you know. Yeah. But Russia is getting very angry. And Putin warned that, you know, they better get their act together or else there's always possible danger of Russian intervention.
All right. Well, now hold it right there. I'm sorry we got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Eric Margulies. More on Ukraine after this. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
So you want to buy some bitcoins? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for cashintocoins.com. Cashintocoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or credit union with shared branching, and then just email them a picture of the receipt with your bitcoin address, and you get your bitcoins, almost always the very same day. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Eric Margulies about Ukraine, and on the way out of the to the break there, Eric, you were saying that the Russians are really serious about this, and if the Ukrainians were to move too far toward the west, the Russians might just roll right in there on tank treads and put a stop to that, huh?
I think the Russians have been very restrained so far, but... you know, imagine how we in the United States would react if Mexico was considering electing a pro-Russian government. Go crazy. Well, Ukraine used to be part of Russia. It's the heartland, the breadbasket. It's the cradle of Russian civilization. So the Russians are very sensitive about it. Putin and his group see what's going on in Ukraine as a continuing Western effort to tear down the Russian Federation, to weaken it, to break away its different parts, and eventually to overthrow his government. I can't say that his view is mistaken. There are Western, empire-building groups that still want to tear down Russia and get final revenge for the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder how much of that, how much is grand strategy or revenge, or is it really just all selling Lockheed products? Because remember, it's just Bruce Jackson, the Lockheed executive that set up the Council for the Expansion of NATO, or Council for NATO Expansion, whatever exactly it was called, but it was the council for coming up with excuses to expand this thing so that we can, basically sell the Americans fighter jets, but call it selling Latvia fighter jets, and it's just a kicking the door open on a new market for a specific company.
Well, that's true, and there's a lot of that to justify the not cutting the Pentagon's bloated budgets, plus the crisis, so-called crisis with Iran. But there's a very serious threat in this whole Ukrainian situation, and I think the U.S. is underestimating Russia. Russia's down, but it's not out. It's rearming itself. Putin's a very tough and clever leader, and he may take action of some sort. I mean, we are provoking and pushing the Russians dangerously.
All right, so now let me ask you about Prince Bandar, because I wonder, when you say we, I mean, as long as we're being loose with the English language here, does we include Prince Bandar, or is it his we that includes us? And, I wonder what you think, what amount of influence he has in, for example, America's Syria policy, or for that matter, Saudi Arabia's Syria policy, and how far they're going. And maybe we could talk a little bit about those talks. But also, a friend of the show, Phil, was bringing up the question of Bandar's seemed pretty obviously a threat that I guess Putin turned around and told the media about, when Bandar told Vladimir Putin, late last year or sometime, late last summer maybe, that, I could protect you from terrorist attacks at your Olympic Games coming up here if you're willing to cooperate with me on Syria, was, I believe, the question. And I just wonder, is that what it looked like? And is that guy, bulletproof? How could he talk to Putin like that and get away with it? And what is going on there?
Well, it sounds like something that the Saudis would have done. They have long been financing the different independence fighters in the Caucasus, whom the Russians and now the Americans call terrorists. That's a pressure point that the Saudis can apply. Bandar is the head of Saudi intelligence. He was a longtime ambassador to Washington. He was always in bed with the Bush family. And he may become the next king of Saudi Arabia. So he's somebody to be listened to and reckoned with. He has a lot of money. He has a lot of influence in the States. We've seen in recent years that the most corrupt institution in the United States is not the New Jersey State Legislature or even the Brooklyn legislature, but rather the American Congress. And you can buy congressmen and senators for a couple of toasters and flat-screen TVs. They are the cheapest people in the world to buy. A few thousand dollars, you've got your senator or congressman. The Saudis spread around a huge amount of money. So they have command great influence in Washington. And they can fund anybody's political party. And they're using it. In fact, they're trying to twist American foreign policy. Now allied between the Saudis and the Israelis, talk about strange bed partners, allied together, trying to force the United States into war in Syria.
All right, now, well, we can get back to that, trying to stop the Iran deal, too, if they can. But now, what's this about Bandar becoming the king? Give me some, play some bets for us here.
Well, the
follow you on intrade.
The senior Saudi leadership, if you want to call it that, are made of a bunch of geriatric princes who are in their 70s and 80s, and all of whom are unwell. The current king is, you know, can barely walk and expected not to live out, live very much longer. There's been a lot of internal infighting in the Saudi royal family between its two main groups. There's a lot of bitterness. There's also a reformist element, which is we don't hear much from. They're scared to death of their own people. They're scared to death of their own army, which isn't given any ammunition. And they are, you know, trying to keep their power in a very changing situation. They're petrified of the Iranians. So they're nervous, his wet hands. And Bandar, though, is Washington's man in Riyadh. He runs the local branch of the CIA and the NSA and everything else. So he's our boy, and right now he's the best-placed candidate, except for one drawback, and that is that his mother was a slave or was descended from a slave girl with African blood. And because of that, he's looked at askance, somewhat impure, by the other Saudi royals. But he's smart and he's rich.
What an advanced society. All right, well, great. Yeah, and now, so what's all this about how jihadists do whatever he says?
The Saudis, you know, with 17 or 16 or of the 18 people who flew the airplanes into New York on 9/11 were Saudis. Mm-hmm. That's been conveniently forgotten. Everybody's blaming the Afghans.
Along with the 28 pages they blacked out of the congressional report.
That's right, Scott. The Saudis have a bottomless well of money to draw from Wahhabi extreme Islamists who will finance your jihad, somebody else's jihad. There are all kinds of different jihads. But the Saudis use it, as you pointed out at the beginning, with the Russians to advance their political goals.
All right. And now, when it comes to the three al-Qaedas in Syria right now, you got the Islamic Front, which the Americans, they were trying to cozy up to as the new replacement for the Free Syrian Army that just kind of disbanded and fled, kind of ran off like Daffy Duck, kind of crazy. And so they were trying to cozy up to the Islamic State, Islamic Front, but they wouldn't meet with them. And then later the guy said, actually, I was associated with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda back then, and I'm still loyal to their goals. But those were the guys that the Americans were going to try to use to, I think, perhaps ally with al-Qaeda number two, the al-Nusra Front, which is at least a little bit more Syrian and nationalist than the Iraqi al-Qaeda guys, who apparently are the worst of the prisoner beheaders and suicide bombers over there in al-Qaeda number three. But then apparently they weren't, I don't know how far they're getting, the Americans or anybody else, the Saudis, Prince Bandar, in getting these groups to, you know, ally the two to ally against the third, or how well they're doing against Assad this whole time they're fighting against each other. Or what do you make of all of that mess?
It's like trying to herd a bunch of hungry cats. Nobody knows who's with all these different groups. American intelligence is not the greatest in dealing with events on the ground. It's like letting the post office run our Middle East policy. They don't know what's happening. They can't follow it fast enough. And we have fooled ourselves, because every group that comes along, we brand them al-Qaeda linked, or al-Qaeda associated, or pro-al-Qaeda. We're so mesmerized by this term al-Qaeda that we apply to all our enemies.
And it's convenient for them, too, that they get to be part of a gigantic global movement, even if they're just a few geeks who once cut a guy's head off.
That's right. The TV cameras come, and suddenly they're famous Amos rather than nobody. But we delude ourselves in understanding how to deal with these people, because we always hear al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda. And we've done that. It worked in Iraq. You know, there were 12 Iraqi resistance groups to the American invasion, And yet, after about a month or two, thanks to the cooperation of the tame American media, they all disappeared.
Yeah, they were all Zarqawi.
And they all became Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda, and that's it.
Right. All right, well, and so now it would seem like if these guys have a lick of sense whatsoever, not that they would ever go hands-off, but they might support the Ba'athist dictator that used to torture Al-Qaeda for them back in the Bush years. But it seems like at the new talks, John Kerry's sticking with the position that Assad must go, which means, in other words, stamp his feet and nothing's going to change. And they're going to keep on backing the Mujahideen. Is that right? Whoever these guys are, call them whatever they are. They do cut people's heads off and blow up suicide bombs amongst women and children.
Yeah, there are a bunch of cutthroats, no doubt about it. The irony of the situation, Scott, is
that... And I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, so real fast.
America's natural ally is the Assad regime.
Yeah, not sad all these, as that is, yeah.
These wild men with black banners. So America's backing the wrong horse from day one.
You think they're ever going to figure that out? I mean, Michael Hayden, who I guess used to work with Assad on torturing people to death, he seems to be recommending it. I don't know if they'll go along with that.
That's right. And we'll discuss it next time.
All right. Well, sorry we're all out of time. Thanks very much for coming
back, Scott,
on the show. I sure appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody, that is the great Eric Margulies, author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Dominate. Check out his great website, ericmargulies.com, for all his great articles there. Also, lourockwell.com and uns.com, UNZ, uns.com. See you next week, or tomorrow, I mean. Thanks for listening.